What do you know that happened between the end of Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, and the beginning of the New Testament? When you get to the end of the Old Testament and the Old Testament ends, the Jews are in Palestine. They've come back. They've rebuilt the temple under the leadership of Zerubbabel. They've come back and they've rebuilt the worship and restored the worship under the leadership of Ezra. And they've rebuilt the walls of the city. When you get to the end of the Old Testament, that's about it. You stop and think about it, that there is that remnant that is there in that promised land, but most of the Jews are still scattered all over the world. Some of them that were scattered in 722 when the northern kingdom was destroyed, and the others that were destroyed and, you know, in 586 when Jerusalem finally was destroyed, there's not many Jews left back in that promised land. A very small number came back, and that's called the remnant. When you get to the end of the Old Testament, the world is being ruled by the Persians, not by Babylon. Babylon has already fallen after 70 years in Babylonian captivity, and the world is being ruled by the Persians. When you open up the New Testament, almost every aspect of that has been changed. The world is now being ruled by the Romans. How on earth did that come back? Here's the Persians, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia over in that part of the world. When you get to the end of the Old Testament, they're the dominant force in the world. And when you get to the opening of the New Testament, you have the Roman government that's there. How did that happen? When you get to the New Testament, there are many things that you begin to read about, and they're very common there in the New Testament, but they've all suddenly appeared. For example, in the Old Testament, how many times do you read about the tax collectors in the Old Testament? How many publicans are there in the Old Testament? Where on earth did these publicans come from? And what about this matter of the synagogues? All of a sudden you get to the New Testament, and in many of the historical books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts, those that are historical in nature, there are synagogues all over the place. Do you know there's not a single synagogue in the Old Testament? Where'd that come from? When you get to the end of the Old Testament and come to the beginning of the New Testament, all of a sudden there are the Herodians, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. How on earth did that come about? And that's really what tonight's lesson is an attempt to do. We've studied over the past several months, we've studied every book of the Old Testament. And it just seems so fitting that we come to the end of that study and talk about what is commonly described as the 400 silent years. What happened? Because it's difficult for us sometimes to understand what happened if we're in the New Testament and understand the things of the New Testament, if we're not aware of what happened during that period of time before the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. And to do that, we're going to look at that period from a political standpoint of the periods between the Testament. There is that period that we date 536 to 332 B.C. of the rule of the Persians. We'll talk about that in the next part of our lesson. And then there's the Grecian period. Alexander the Great and that which followed his death from 332 to 167 B.C. And then there's that period of independence, sometimes called the Maccabean period, from 167 to 63 B.C. And then there's the Roman period, from 63 up until Matthew 1. Let's look at it. Go back to that Persian period and the dates we give, and that's in the notes that you've been given, is 536 is the time for the fall of the Babylonians, and the Persians began that rule. In the first year of the fall of Babylon, when the Persians just began ruling, the first thing that happens is that Cyrus sends the Jews back to Palestine. And we've talked about that as we've looked in recent weeks about Zerubbabel and about Ezra and about Nehemiah. All of a sudden, these Jews that have been scattered all over the world, a worldwide decree goes out. And the Jews come back and reestablish Judaism. But Palestine does not have the grandeur that it had during the days of David and during the days of Solomon. During the time when it was a great power, when there were some righteous kings, the Jews are not there. They're just a group of individuals that's there under the Persian rulers who were, as one book described them, who were mild and tolerant. They allowed the Jews to come back, and once they established that nation, they were allowed to do just about anything they wanted to religiously. There's not a whole lot that happens during this period of time of the latter part of that Persian rule. But then all of a sudden, we get to the verses that were read in Daniel chapter 8. You might want to open up your Bible to Daniel chapter 8. Because in this reading tonight, and I don't know what you thought is this vision that Daniel saw. I don't know what you thought about when you read about this ram that had two horns. And about this goat that just had one horn and he came running across the earth. I don't know what you thought about when that goat ran into that ram and knocked him down, and then the horn on that goat was broken. Somebody says, sounds to me like he's been on LSD or some kind of drugs or something of that nature. No. God has given him a vision using animals of some of the things that transpired during the time of the Grecian world. Sometimes we call these years the 400 silent years. The reality is they're silent in the fact that there is no living prophet after the time of Malachi. But in the book of Daniel especially, there's events after events that are described, many of them in chapter 11 in great detail. So that God's prophets were there, they were just not any living prophets. God was going to tell them what happened. Now, to understand this vision, if you don't know about verse 20 and 21 in Daniel chapter 8, you might ought to underline that in your Bible. Because when you read this, it's just about some animals that are running each other, and one's knocking the other one down. And one, that goat that's a flying goat because it doesn't touch the earth, and he has one horn in it, you know. I try to think of him as a unigoat. I don't know there's any such word, but that's a good way to describe this goat that comes across the earth with just one horn. And then all of a sudden, after he knocks this ram down, that horn is broken. Look in verse 20 that says, you know who that ram is? That ram that you saw having two horns represents the dual kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. The Persians actually were the more dominant power, and that's why in the story of the ram that was there, the horn that came up last was larger than the first horn that was on that ram. And then the verse says, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. Now Daniel is writing these things in the third year, look in verse 1, of the reign of Belshazzar. Here is the time near the end of the fall of Babylon, and he has a vision from God to tell him everything that's going to happen. So when we get to the end of that Persian Empire, we come to the Grecian Empire, that second period. And it has to do with Alexander the Great. that unigoat that came flying across the earth. By the way, geographically it came from the west. If you stand stand in Persia, you look to the west, and that is the exact direction where Greece lies, away from Persia. And he sees this goat coming, and he has one horn, and God says, and that horn is its first king. And so history shows us that when Alexander the Great's father unified the Grecian city-states, did you ever think when you were in high school and learned about Sparta and about all of those Greek city-states, they'd have any real use ever in your life? But Philip of Macedon took his great leadership ability and united the nation of Greece, not into city-states, but into one nation. And he organized an army of 40,000 and came flying out of the west to fight the Persians. There's one indication that said the Persian army had 1 million soldiers. Alexander the Great came with an army of 40,000 against 1 million soldiers, and he was told, when the Persians shoot a volley of arrows, it will darken the sun. And my favorite quote, I think, from secular history is, Alexander the Great says, "That's wonderful. Today we get to fight in the shade." And using military tactics that were really, really amazing. And if you have any interest at all, you ought to learn how he developed the technique so he could defeat the Persian army. In fact, before he actually got into the area of Persia, he came down into Palestine, came down into Egypt. And finally he went over and destroyed the kingdoms of Persia and kept on going farther west, and went all the way to India and would have gone on to China. But his soldier says, "This is far enough." And so at age 33, he died. And there came about the vision of that Grecian kingdom. You remember in the vision what happened when the one horn was broken? Four horns came up in its place. How did Daniel know what was going to happen? One of the great evidences of inspiration is that Daniel could write of things that were nearly 300 years away and says, coming out of the west, coming out of Greece, he names it by name. What was Greece like in 600 B.C.? Just a little insignificant place. And yet, by inspiration, Daniel saw Alexander the Great, and he saw the death of Alexander the Great, and at age 33, he died. And he left no appointed successor, for his statement was, "Let the strong rule." And upon his death, that kingdom was divided into four sub-kingdoms. There is that which concerned Persia and that part of the world. There is that which concerned Turkey and that which concerned Greece and the areas that would be west of Greece. But there was that division that impacted the people down in Egypt. And the rulers down in Egypt, most of them, wore the name Ptolemy because he was one of the powerful generals of Alexander the Great when he died, and he immediately established his place and said, "This is where I'm going to be." The other kingdom was that which is that concerns biblical history, is that which was north of Palestine where Syria was. And that is the Seleucid rulers. But before talking about that, let's talk about the fact that at first, the Jews were under the Ptolemy rulers down in the land of Egypt. And there were some good things that happened down there. The Ptolemies brought down a group of individuals to be a part in that land, and by that I mean Jewish individuals. And they were commissioned in order that they might enhance the library that was there in Alexandria, Egypt. Wonder who that's named after. Alexander the Great had come into Egypt and named and built a city there and named it after himself. But they translated the Bible that was in the Hebrew language into the Greek language. I don't believe we can overemphasize the importance of that translation of the Bible. When you get to the New Testament, there are very few who speak Greek or Aramaic in Palestine. But the language that is known around the world is the Greek language, because the Greek culture was spread around the world. And so they had a Bible that anybody in the Roman world of the New Testament, because Greek was still the dominant language even in the Roman world, anybody could understand and have the Bible read to them, because during the time after the death of Alexander the Great, and when the Jews who were there in Palestine were in favor with those down in the land of Egypt, they were there, they built a temple to God, or built a place to worship God, and there developed at this time the synagogues. What on earth is a synagogue? There's not one synagogue in all of the Old Testament. And those whose view of the Old Testament worship is based solely on the New Testament arrive at the conclusion that the way the Sabbath day was kept holy was that the Jews would come together and for want of a better word, have church. They'd come together and they'd sing and they'd pray. And they'd come together and they'd read the Scriptures. But that's not the way the Sabbath was observed in the Old Testament. The synagogues came about because there were these Jews in Egypt and in Persia and Syria and Assyria and in all of Asia Minor and in Rome and in Italy and in North Africa. There were Jews that were scattered around, and so they decided, not in the Old Testament time, but they decided there would be a worship assembly on the Sabbath. There was no holy convocation, gathering, congregating of the Jews on the Sabbath day in the Old Testament. But when one gets to the New Testament, you read about Paul's missionary journey, and in Gentile city after Gentile city, when Paul arrived in that city, he went to the synagogues. Why? Because that's where the people are assembled who believe in the Bible, believe in the Old Testament. They don't believe in Jesus. And Paul does not go into that synagogue there to worship according to a Jewish way, because that was just, he was sort of keeping the Sabbath. If you'll read what happened when he got in the synagogues, when he stood up and preached the truth, he was driven out of the synagogues. He went there to try to change the lives of those people that were there. And so when you have the Ptolemy rulers, you have the synagogues, and you have that translation of the Old Testament called Septuagint. Then, north of Palestine, with Egypt being to the south and the west of Palestine, north of Palestine is Syria, where the Seleucid rulers are found. It's important to think about Seleucid rulers. About 198 B.C., so if you've got Alexander the Great, 332 B.C., his death not many years after that, And then about 100 years, the people are down to being dominated and influenced. The Jews are being influenced by the nation, the powerful nation, one of those four kingdoms that came whenever the big horn was broken and the four horns came in its place. One of those horns was Egypt, and the Jews are dominated by Egyptian culture. Well, but more by Greek culture that came out of the land of Egypt. But about 198, the pendulums went to the other extreme. And no longer were the Jews being dominated by the Egyptian Greek generals, but it was being dominated by those who were a part of the Grecian world in Syria, the land just north of Palestine. And so we enter into a period of independence. How did that independence come about? One name associated with that is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means the illuminated one, the light of the world. It is almost an evidence of the worship of rulers as though they were kings. His name is Epiphanes. The Jews nicknamed him Epimanes. It's a play on that word. Epiphanes means the illustrious one. Epimanes means the crazy one. He was very harsh in the dealing with the Jews. And so he went down against Egypt about 168 B.C. And in a battle that had been going on for a hundred years between Egypt and Syria, with the Jews caught sort of right in the middle. And normally when those battles were fought, the Egyptians would rule. He went down, the Egyptians were rebelling. He went from Syria, came down through Palestine, and went down to Egypt. And the report was that he was killed. The Jews began to celebrate. And was it Mark Twain who said the report of his death was highly exaggerated? And so Epimanes, the crazy one, came back to Jerusalem and went to the temple and desecrated the temple by taking the entrails of swine. Remember how the Jews felt towards swine and the unclean aspect of them being an unclean animal. And as it were, walked into the holy place and the most holy place and whitewashed the holy place and the most holy place with the guts and blood of hogs. He was Epimanes. Shortly thereafter, he sent rulers, some of his soldiers, down among the Jews to demand that they worship the gods of the Syrians, the gods of the Greeks, to burn incense to them. No Jew could do that conscientiously. And in a village not that far from Jerusalem, there was a man by the name of Mattathias. He had several sons. And when they came to this village, they selected him to be the one to set the stage for all of the people in that village. If we can get this older man, Mattathias, to sacrifice in honor of worshiping this idol that's here, then everybody in the city will follow suit. And though Mattathias was somewhat advanced in age, he stood there and grabbed the sword of those two men who were there to force everybody in that village to worship Caesar and killed every one of them. And he and his sons fled from that place and started a rebellion against the Syrians, against the Seleucid rulers. If you think about Castro and Batista, Castro's army was not all that well equipped, but they could fight. And they went into the mountains down there of Cuba and they did all they could to just stay, be a thorn in the side of the ruler of Cuba, until finally that government was overthrown and Castro was able to become the dictator of that land. You know what happened in Palestine? Mattathias and his sons led a rebellion, and that rebellion is called Maccabees. The Maccabean Rebellion. The word Maccabees means hammer. And while Mattathias was not the one, his son Judas came back inside that temple and rededicated, purified that temple. It was about 3 years from the time of the desecration of the temple by Epiphanes, and the purification of it by Judas Maccabees. Do you have your Bible still open to Daniel chapter 8? Verse 12 says, here in reference to this little horn mentioned in verse 8 that grew out of the four horns after Alexander the Great died, one of these little horns grew up, and he exalted himself, verse 11, as high as the prince of hosts, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his, meaning God's sanctuary, was cast down. In verse 13, Daniel said he heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, to that certain one speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation of giving both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot, trampled underfoot?" You see, that's what Epiphanes did. He came and desecrated and stopped the sacrifice. For how long? Well, the King James says, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Have you got a marginal reading on the word days? Look in verse 14. If you have a marginal reading, it says, until 2,300 evenings, mornings. Are you aware that there was a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice? And so instead of saying 2,300 days, he says 2,300 evening mornings. The number of daily sacrifices that would be offered. Half of 2,300 is 1,150. From the time Epimenes came and stopped the daily sacrifice until the day that Judas Maccabees went in and purified the temple, would it surprise you at all to know it was 1,150 days? How on earth could Daniel, 550, 600 B.C., write the things that he writes down to Alexander the Great, his kingdom being divided into four kingdoms, and looking at an event that would happen in 168 B.C., and look again 3 years later, 165 B.C., whenever the temple was purified? That ought to build your faith. Judas Maccabees and his brothers and the descendants of the Maccabees did a thing that later brought about some rather grave problems, and that is in that they unified the civil government of Jerusalem with the priesthood. God had intended that the high priest be of the tribe of Levi and that they be spiritual in their nature. But Judas Maccabees and his family decided that they, maybe perhaps by default because they were such great warriors, that they could be the high priest and they could lead this unified political religious group. When you get to the New Testament, Are you aware of a group among the Jews, one of the Jewish sects, that was far more political than were the Pharisees? Oh, yes. They were the ones who were in charge of the Sanhedrin. They were the ones through whom, before whom Paul was brought. And whenever he said, "I'm a Pharisee," a riot broke out in the Sanhedrin because there were both Sadducees and Pharisees that were there. This unifying of the civil government with the priesthood created some problems when you get to the New Testament, where you read of Annas and Caiaphas both being high priest. You can't have two high priests alive at the same time. But they did in the New Testament. You know why? Because in the years that followed, the office of high priest was put up for the highest bidder, who'd give the most money to those in political power, Roman governors. It was a political, religious group. There was that Grecian influence on Jewish society. The word gymnasium is on the screen. The Greek influence was so great that those who wanted to gain the favor of the Greeks who were up in Syria, that they were the ones who said, "Let's build a gymnasium right here. Let's put an Olympic track right here at the foot of the temple." And Jewish young men no longer wanted to go to the temple. They wanted to get involved in the Greek culture and in what the things that we would know as the Olympics, and that which the Romans brought on whenever they were later to become in power. And so there was great political and religious unrest. Well, what came out of this was that with the overthrow of the Syrian domination, the family of Judas Maccabees and those that came after developed a spirit of independence. And so if you're able to find a map of this period of independence, the years we have on the chart are 167 to about 63 B.C., you'll see that their influence reached way up, beyond, up into Galilee. It encompassed all of Judea. The boundaries of that kingdom were far-reaching. But then all of a sudden, in 63, Rome comes into the picture, and we enter the period of Roman domination. Palestine was conquered by Pompey, and his form of government and the choice that he made was to appoint one of his friends down in Edom, by this time called Idumea, the New Testament name for that area. Antipater was that man's name. And Pompey, for political reasons, appointed Antipater as the ruler of the Jews. His son was named Herod. Herod was not Jewish, fully so. He was part Idumean and part Jewish. And so when you get to the New Testament and you begin reading about Herod, we know this one is Herod the Great. He is the one who brought in the matter of tax collectors. He is the one who set up a group of men to collect money for Rome. Where did they come from? They came from a half-Jewish person ruling over Judea with Rome supporting him, and so he could cater to Rome. He collected the taxes for Rome. He's the one who built the temple, or remodeled the temple. There was that temple that Solomon built, and there was that temple that Zerubbabel built. But when Herod gets onto the throne, he creates a temple that is the marvel of the world, with some of those stones weighing more than 40 tons. You remember what Jesus said about that temple? Not one stone will be left upon another. And some of them weighed whatever 40 times 2,000 is. Is that 80,000 pounds? That's remarkable in and of itself, that Jesus could look at that temple that Herod the Great had built. And he'd spent 46 years. You remember when Jesus said, in 3 days, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll rebuild it. Or, you know, it will be raised again. He's talking to the temple of his body. And they said, 46 years have been involved in this. What's he talking about? Not about Zerubbabel's temple, not about Solomon's temple, but about the modernization that Alexander had brought on that. Now in Palestine, there were those individuals who favored the rule of the Herods. You know where the Herodians came from? It was the Jews who liked the Herods and the lifestyle they had under the Herods. And even though there was a spirit of independence in that land, politically they were Herodians. And when you get to the New Testament, it's the Herodians that come and tempt Jesus. Then there were those who were renegades and wanted to do everything they could to destroy any Roman influence at all. And they were the Zealots, Zelotes. In fact, Jesus chose Simon Zelotes, a guerrilla fighter, to become one of the apostles. I know nothing about him other than his name and the likelihood of where that name came from, as these individuals who were there trying to overthrow Rome. It's remarkable the mixture that Jesus brought together. Somebody says, you've talked about the Sadducees and their political aspect when you get to the New Testament. Oh, they had the religious aspect. Remember, they didn't believe in the resurrection or angels or spirits. But they were so politically oriented. They were first political, secondarily they were religious. On the other hand, were the Pharisees. Where did they come from? The Pharisees came from that period of time during the independence of the Jews, whenever those temples, whenever the gymnasiums were being built at the foot of the temple, and when there was a magnification of Greek culture among the Jews, there were those who said, we must not depart from the Old Testament law, and they became known as the Pharisees. Here's a mindset that says we got to live right and do right, which is a mindset that is right. But that mindset can become a head belief and not a heartfelt soul belief. And that's why when you get to the New Testament, the religion of the Pharisees primarily was external. Religious, absolutely. You couldn't rub your hands together with grain on the Sabbath day, otherwise you were working. You had to wash your hands before you ate. There are all sort of rituals of like the Sabbath day's journey. That's not a God-given thing. It's a rule the Pharisees had made about how to keep the Sabbath day holy and how far you could walk on the Sabbath day. Where did that come from? It came from the religious fanatics who began as a reaction against the secularization of Judaism and evolved into a system of religion that was external and formal. One other thing about Herod the Great, and that is, there was that day when wise men came from the east and came to his palace and said to Herod the Great, where is he that's born king of the Jews? That gets us to the book of Matthew, doesn't it? Oh, there were other Herods after this. Herod Agrippa, Herod Philip. There were his descendants that are other Herods that are mentioned in the Bible. But it is this Herod, this Idumean, this individual who is half Edomite descendants of Esau and half Jewish descendants of Jacob. And he's wherever Jesus is born. It's remarkable that there, while there were no living prophets, God told us so much about what would happen. And perhaps sometime we'll have time to get into Daniel chapter 11, where in that chapter there's a description of the Seleucid rulers and the Ptolemaic rulers down in Egypt and the intermarriage and the interrelationship in unbelievable great detail of battle after battle that those two kings fought against each other during what we call the 400 silent years. Silent in the sense that there was no living prophets. But there was God's prophetical message that the people could see being fulfilled before their eyes. Antiochus Epiphanes, the one who stops the daily sacrifice, and 2,300 sacrifices later, it's restored. God is there, and the fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies could become the basis for unbelievable, tremendous faith. That's the end of this lesson, and I hope it helps us to see that we've begun in the book of Genesis. We've come all the way through to the first chapter of Matthew. We'll take several weeks, maybe, 2 or 3 months before we come again and start again on our Sunday night in Soldiers of Christ. It's possible that you want to become a Christian tonight, or you want to, as a Christian, to confess wrong in your life. God's plan of salvation is found in the New Testament. And if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, then will you not tonight repent and confess Christ and be baptized in Him that He might add you to the church? Or if you're an unfaithful Christian who needs the prayers of the church, you could also respond to this invitation as together we stand and sing. Will you come?